Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today in the program, we will talk about some COVID-19 blow-ups across the state, including in Sweetwater County, where they were forced to cancel all elective surgeries.
That we are using the nurses that would be on doing elective surgeries to take care of the critical COVID patients that we have right now.
To Hot Springs County, where the school district was forced to go online and the caseload skyrocketed.
I think that it's just sort of a natural consequence of having a Delta variant that is much more contagious.
Plus, the federal government is rounding up thousands of wild horses to save them from the region's severe drought.
People want to say, let Mother Nature take its course, but boy, that's the stuff nightmares are made of.
Join us for those stories in an episode of our Kids Ask Why podcast. It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. COVID-19 cases are continuing to grow across the state, and that has led to some implications. On Monday, Memorial Hospital of Sweetwater County announced they're canceling all elective surgeries for now. This comes as the Rock Springs Hospital had a completely full intensive care unit. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadelska speaks with the Director of Emergency Services and Incident Commander Kim White to understand why elective surgeries had to be canceled.
That we are using the nurses that would be on doing elective surgeries to take care of the critical COVID patients that we have right now. We are able to do emergent and medically necessary surgeries, so we haven't cut down all surgeries, just the elective ones that a patient can still be safe and still maintain their health until we're able to get those until a later date when we're able to get those surgeries done.
Okay. And as I understand, you're experiencing, or the Memorial Hospital is experiencing, a staff shortage. Is this part of the problem?
We have had a few nurses leave on our inpatient side, so that has definitely caused a decrease in bed availability. We don't have the ability to ship people out very often. Every once in a while, we get this miracle minute where we are able to find a bed in another facility for our sickest patients. But the biggest thing impacting us right now is that we have 11 COVID patients admitted to our hospital, and 8 of those are critical care. And so those patients require a smaller patient to nurse ratio, and they require more hands on deck to take care of them. And so that's what our surgery nurses are doing right now, is they are helping out in our COVID unit /ICU and also helping on the medical floor. And then also the ER has been so inundated with COVID that they're helping down there as well. So they are taking care of the more critical patients right now. And that's what's taken away their ability, our ability to help with elective surgeries.
Do you think it's the staff shortage or influx of COVID patients or both that brought you to where you are now?
It's a little bit of both, but right now, this past week and a half, it's definitely more the increase in COVID patients. These patients are on high amounts of oxygen. They're on BiPAP machines, which help them breathe, and some of them are having to be intubated. And so it requires more time, more treatments and things like that. And so, when you have this amount of patients, we haven't had this amount of COVID patients admitted to our facility throughout the entire, at any one time during the pandemic. And so unfortunately, we can't send these patients to higher level of cares because they're full as well. We have been able to get a few, like I said, when we have that miracle moment when a bed opens up, when we call, that's few and far between. So the fact that we have higher acuity patients, we have more patients than we usually have is what's hurting us the most right now, or not hurting us necessarily, but making it impossible to be able to do the elective surgeries.
As I understand, the ICU was full this past weekend. Is it still full, or are there beds available already?
We actually have today 2 beds available in our ICU. So we do have, which is nice, we do have that. So, the big thing is not only is it COVID patients, but we have other patients with other diagnoses that are needing those ICU beds as well.
And as the incident commander, what's the plan if the ICU is full and you can't send patients to other hospitals?
Yep. So that's the other reason why elective surgeries have been postponed. We would actually start moving patients down or admitting patients into our same day surgery area, which has the ability, it has the monitors, it has the oxygen, and it has everything that we need to be able to take care of patients down there as well.
Are the majority of COVID patients unvaccinated?
Yes, the majority of them are unvaccinated. And can I add to that real quick? So I know that, you know, I've personally been asked, you know, if that's a privacy invasion of privacy to know whether or not someone is vaccinated. And my answer to that is, even prior to COVID, when people come into the ER, we ask them if they're up to date on vaccinations. So it's just a routine health question that we ask. It's not just because of COVID. It's simply because we want to make sure, you know, if you've got a cut finger, are you up to date on your tetanus shot? You know, you're coming in with the flu. Have you had flu-like symptoms? Have you had your flu shot? You know, those are all typical things that we ask. And so it's no different now with COVID than it was prior to COVID.
Okay. And how would the situation have to change so that elective surgeries can start again?
So with the plan that we have in place, we start looking at elective surgeries based on the acuity and the number of patients that we have. If we were able to get back down to a better number of patients, both COVID and non-COVID patients requiring ICU or requiring beds upstairs, then we would be able to. I don't want to say a definite number just because it is based on acuity and the treatment that the patients require. But typically, I would say around 5 or 6 patients in the ICU would be more manageable for us to be able to open up. This is not a decision that we want to make. You know, we have our own staff members that are on that list of elective surgeries that are unable to, you know, take place at this time. Not that they take more importance over anyone else, but, you know, it is hard when you see someone on a daily basis and you're constantly having to tell them that, you know, not today, not today. We want to get elective surgeries opened back up as soon as possible. That's our first priority. We evaluate it every day. As soon as we can, we'll get it back open. And I hope that people just understand that, you know, we're just having to prioritize who has the more critical need at this time.
All right. Well, I've been speaking to Dr. Kim White. She's the Memorial Hospital of Sweetwater County's Emergency Services Director and Incident Commander. Thanks for speaking with me.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you helping us give information out.
The Hot Springs County School District raised some eyebrows when they canceled activities like football and pushed classes to online offerings this week due to a sudden spike in COVID-19 cases. The cases have impacted the entire town. Dr. Vernon Miller is the county health officer, and I asked him to explain what's going on.
You know, we are a tourist destination, so we have lots of folks from out of town. There have been several somewhat larger gatherings lately. We have not been able to get much data out of our contact tracing to be able to cut that down or, you know, trace that down as specifically as we would like. But I think that it is just a part of everything that's happening in Wyoming at this point, and ours just is a small county with a small population, and those numbers just zoomed because people got together when they shouldn't.
Can you kind of describe what you're seeing out there? Is this spreading a lot? Does it seem like it's focused on a certain number of people? What sort of is the situation there?
The schools closed based on the fact that they reached a threshold of staff and students that were in quarantine or were sick, and they just decided to close for 10 days and do a terminal clean and hope that we're able to get past this. Our hospital, like most hospitals in Wyoming, is full. You know, our resources are stretched pretty thin. I think I am seeing an uptick in people coming in for immunizations because they think they understand as they see more of their friends and loved ones get sick, it's become more real to them. It's not just something they hear about in the news or watch on TV. I think that it's just sort of a natural consequence of having a Delta variant that is much more contagious, and people continuing to, you know, have some gatherings that it allows it to spread more rapidly. It is probably more virulent as well. You know, when I talk to my counterparts in other parts of the state, we may be a little higher this week, but they may be higher next week. I think it's going to be statewide.
Well, you answered my question. I was going to ask you about vaccinations. And so is it a pretty steady stream from what maybe you've seen up till now?
Well, it's a somewhat steadier trickle. I wouldn't describe it as a stream yet. Our immunization rate is, you know, fairly good, and or certainly better in our seniors. It's in, you know, at least low 60s. In our adolescents, it's around 12%, those who are eligible by age. And regular adults, it's still less than
50%. Overall, it's only about 37%. There's still a great deal of vaccine hesitancy here for a variety of reasons. Many people have lots of different reasons for it. And what I try to stress is that there is no vaccine for anything that's 100% safe. This one's certainly been out there. It's been tested, used in, you know, millions of people. And we know pretty much what the side effects can be. But we certainly know what the side effects of getting COVID can be, both short-term and long-term. And, you know, if you put it in balance, it is certainly safer to get a vaccine than to get COVID. If you've already had COVID, getting a vaccine will certainly improve your immune system a lot, more than just getting the COVID itself. So we're recommending vaccines to everyone who's eligible.
I know you're very busy. I'll let you go. I just wanted to just ask, is there anything I forgot to ask that you would like a chance to say?
We did a lot of, last year, a lot of, you know, masking and social distancing and hand hygiene and lots of things just as a stopgap, knowing they weren't 100% effective by any means, but they were all we had until we had vaccines, and we were looking forward to getting the vaccines. Now that we have them, if people choose not to use a vaccine, then they need to go back to those things like masking and social distancing and hand hygiene until we get past this to a better place. We can't just do none of the above. It isn't going to work.
Dr. Miller, thank you so much for your time.
You're certainly welcome.
When we come back, we'll have a couple of stories on how the climate is impacting some outdoor species. This is Open Spaces.
The Modern West Podcast, audio storytelling with a finger on the pulse of the West.
That was the last wolf that Dad had heard of in the valley.
Journey into a morphing world.
It's all because of the coal mine. Yeah. I mean, it was a good living.
Where old stereotypes fall apart.
All right, Gladys, are we ready to give that girl their scores?
And you get to be yourself. Binge episodes now at themodernwest.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. There are more than 70,000 wild horses across the country, and many are suffering due to the West's severe drought. Some are even dying. Now the federal government is trying to save them by rounding up thousands and sending them to new homes. But as the Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie reports, some wild horse advocates say the animals are not going to happy homes. They're going to slaughter.
A black helicopter swoops past a herd of wild horses running across western Utah's high desert. It's mid-morning and already hot. The helicopter is trying to herd these animals into a corral. Lisa Reed is watching the action while sitting on a blanket under an umbrella.
The helicopter works like a sheepdog. It works the horses from side to side, guiding them to the direction that he wants them to go.
Reed is with the Bureau of Land Management. It's in the middle of a huge emergency campaign to get roughly 6,000 wild horses like these out of the desert and onto private stables or pastures. That's because some of their dependable water sources are drying up and their forage is dying.
People want to say, let Mother Nature take its course, but boy, that's the stuff nightmares are made of.
Reed remembers reading reports about a small group of wild horses who died from dehydration during the West's last severe drought 2 decades ago.
There was one foal that was still alive, and it was nursing off of a dead mom, and that's heartbreaking.
The wild horses rounded up today are faring better than that, but not by much. At a nearby corral, some of the mares look gaunt.
You can see their ribs and their hip bones, and that is definitely a direct impact from the drought.
Unlike other desert critters such as bighorn sheep or mule deer, the U.S. government can't just let wild horses die off. A 50-year-old federal law ensures that there are a set number of healthy horses living on healthy rangelands. But lately, the BLM has argued that there are too many wild horses. With few natural predators, the herds grow by up to 25% each year. That's creating unhealthy conditions, and the drought is making things worse. So the agency is rounding up the horses and adopting them out.
It's different than picking up a puppy at the pound. You've got to spend lots of time with them.
That's Dwayne Oldham. He owns a wild horse sanctuary on the Wind River Indian Reservation in Wyoming.
I don't recommend it. You watch one YouTube video and go try to do it.
Instead, he says the horses are often adopted by experienced handlers such as ranchers, hunting outfitters, or sheep herders. They also sometimes go to small stables in places as varied as Houston or West Virginia. But the adoption program and the roundups themselves are also controversial.
The roundups lead to slaughter. There's just no way of getting around it.
Suzanne Roy is executive director of the nonprofit American Wild Horse Campaign. She says the problem stems from BLM incentives. A year after adopting a horse, owners get $1,000 from the government.
What people are doing is they're collecting the cash incentive, and as soon as the money clears their banks, they're sending the horses to the slaughter auction.
Slaughtering horses is banned in the United States, but some of these animals are bought at auctions, also known as sell barns, and then sent to Canada or Mexico where slaughter is legal. Roy's organization has identified nearly 100 wild horses and burros auctioned at sell barns in recent months. She wants the BLM to invest more heavily in fertility control to bring down the population and to install wells to help with the drought.
We think it's time for the BLM to stop looking at ways to remove horses from the land and start looking at ways to protect them on the land.
The agency is using fertility control on some herds. It's also been hauling water for horses to drink.
Hauling water is like a Band-Aid.
Gus War, director of the BLM's Wild Horse and Burro Program in Utah, says, bottom line, roundups are the best way to get horses quickly off of drought-stricken rangelands. As for the slaughterhouses, in July, the BLM implemented tougher screening measures to weed out bad adopters. War acknowledges that the new protections only go so far. After a year, an adopted wild horse becomes private property.
Once it's private property, if somebody wants to sell it to a friend or a neighbor, and it might end up at a sell barn, then those individuals have that legal right.
War also stresses that a majority of adopted wild horses don't end up at these sell barns. They go to good homes. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Western Utah.
Many know the monarch butterfly is declining. It's linked to human expansion and the rise of global temperatures. But monarchs are not the only butterflies dealing with these threats. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel has more.
Wide open spaces like these are in much of Wyoming, and they're known to be strongholds for pollinators like butterflies. They often contain critical habitat and food resources far away from the disturbance of human civilization. But according to researcher Katie Prudick, it turns out even those areas are under threat.
I think in the past we thought wildlands, you know, we could just set them aside away from humans and they would be fine because our impact is direct, right?
Prudick is a researcher from the University of Arizona who studied the impacts global warming is having on butterfly numbers. She says butterflies and many other species are showing signs of being impacted indirectly by humans.
When we think about these impacts of warming or drought or fire or these things that are related to climate change, then we need to be thinking about managing wildlands with intent and with a mind towards that they'll be affected in strange ways that are a little unpredictable, that aren't about direct human impact.
Prudick says the impact on butterflies is not good.
So what we found is that on average, there's an almost 2% annual decline of butterfly population across the West.
That's overall, but there is a bit of variation between species, with some doing better than others. But the researchers say it's clear that the declines were seen in areas with fall warming and drought.
Well, this was a surprise for us because most of the literature has really focused on spring changes. In terms of timing, spring has been the focus of the work because that's when, you know, everything emerges and then, you know, things have to be ready. The plants have to be available for the butterfly to lay eggs on and the caterpillars to eat and those sorts of things.
She says this is important because fall is when butterflies are building fat reserves for winter hibernation.
we think the plants are senescing or dying back sooner because they're under drought conditions. And we also think their quality is decreased by the droughts, the ones that aren't senescing, so that they're not providing great nutritious food for the caterpillars and the adult butterflies as they prepare for hibernation.
Prudick says this pattern is applicable across the West, not just in the area she and her team studied. But University of Wyoming researchers say there isn't enough historical data on the state's butterfly population to determine that for sure. Lesha Tronstad is an invertebrate zoologist with the Wyoming Natural Diversity Database housed at UW.
We don't have a lot of past data. Most of the information on butterflies is in the mountains because that's where people want to be when they collect butterflies. And so we don't have a lot of information for the rest of Wyoming.
Tronstad and her graduate student Maddie Crawford have been trying to establish baseline data for the state's butterflies for the past few years. Crawford says the state's open spaces are special.
Wyoming's rangelands are really good for butterflies. Unlike some other states, we do have rangelands instead of crops. So we have a bigger variety of flowers that these butterflies can choose from. So Wyoming may be a really good resource for these insects to use.
But she says no matter how much we have, it's all threatened by increasing temperatures.
In general, if our summers continue to get warmer and drier, some plants are going to have a hard time adjusting to that change quick enough to be able to produce a good enough amount of flowers for these insects to use.
Tronstad agrees and adds that if one struggles, they both do.
Plants and pollinators are very closely tied, and one cannot survive without the other.
So protecting butterflies means protecting the plants they're so tightly linked with, too. Researcher Katie Prudick suggests giving butterflies similar protections as some birds.
I think sort of riffing off the Migratory Bird Act would be a great place to start. So we know that that's been really successful at increasing wetland bird population sizes. And so if we can start incorporating into those management plans, plants and sort of habitat associated with the butterflies that are locally there, that would probably go a long way.
All three researchers agree that individuals can help protect butterflies by lowering their climate impact. Another good way is to join citizen science projects which help track these insects and learn more about your local native species. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
In a moment, we're going to break away from the hard news and bring you an episode of our Kids Ask Why podcast. This is Open Spaces.
A startup is trying to save the planet by developing a special technology. And it could all come together if they manage to win an international competition. It's gonna be tough, but folks think this CEO is the guy to do it.
I don't have a good way to put this that doesn't sound cheesy, but kind of like this mythical dude that like just out there to just like be rad and just spread stoke.
Binge all of Carbon Valley now. Listen at carbonvalleypodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming Public Media is involved in a number of podcast efforts, and from time to time, we like to highlight some of those. This podcast is produced by Camila Kudelska, and it's called Kids Ask Why.
Why?
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 Why? Why do wildlife biologists need to study the bears and wolves of Wyoming?
Why?
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 Why should Heart Mountain be protected?
Welcome to the Kids Ask Why podcast,
where kids ask the questions. This is a collaboration between Wyoming Public Media and the Buffalo Bill Center of the West.
Today we are going to be learning about some things that make Wyoming special.
is Charlotte Quick. I live in Cody, Wyoming, and I am 8 years old. I just finished the second grade at Sunset Elementary School. Two of my favorite subjects are reading and science. I love living in Wyoming because we are surrounded by mountains and wildlife. Some of my favorite things to do in my area of Wyoming are going rafting, paddleboarding, biking, skiing, and exploring rocks and caves with my friends. I chose to interview my Uncle Phil Quick, who is a large carnivore biologist for the Wyoming Game and Fish. I wanted to visit with him because even though he's my uncle, I wanted to learn more about his job. One time, Uncle Phil came to our house after trapping a black bear. The bear was asleep though, so I got to see it in the big trap. I thought that was really neat and I wanted to learn more and share it with you.
Okay. Why do you have to trap bears and wolves?
Well, sometimes we trap bears for conflict reasons. That's like if they're around somebody's house or digging into their, you know, sheds, breaking stuff, or sometimes killing livestock. Other times we trap bears as a research just to get some information on them. And we can find out a lot of interesting things about bears just by catching a small sample size of the population. So we compare how many males and females we catch, how old they are. And when we capture a bear, even if it's for a conflict or for research, we do a full workup on them. So we pull a tooth and we can age the bear from the marks in its tooth, or like almost like the rings of a tree. We can use protein isotopes to find out what its diet mainly has been. And you can also look in there on its diet and find out if it has been eating human-based food, because almost any human-based food has some sort of corn in it eventually, or livestock food. So it's a pretty extensive workup, but all that data is very useful in monitoring our bear numbers and our overall condition of our bears.
And where do you usually find the bears and wolves?
Well, mostly in the mountains, although sometimes lately that's been changing a little bit. Sometimes the plains too, to a degree in the foothills. But the wolves really like to have a place where they can den, and then they fan out from there. So they like to have a den that's close to a water source and somewhat shaded. And sometimes there'll be three or four holes in a similar within a 300-yard area, and they have those holes that are just kind of like extras for the pups to dive into. And there'll be one main den where the mama nurses the babies when they're little. And as the babies make a mess in that first den, she'll move them up to the next den. And sometimes she won't get in the next den with them. She'll just wait around outside. And as they get bigger, they move to what's called a rendezvous site, which is usually a place that has some shade and some wet grass and some places that the babies can lay around and stay cool while all the adults are out hunting. And the fourth part about the wolves is they also want to strategically dig a den or place their rendezvous sites where they can follow game as it migrates back into the mountains. So as far as the bears, we see bears from everywhere, from the highest mountain peaks doing moth sites where they dig and turn over talus rocks and eat army cutworm moths off the other side, which is a big food source for bears, grizzly bears that is. You see a black bear up there once in a while, but not real often. And then we see them all the way down, all the way out to like Chapman's Bench in Heart Mountain on the outskirts of Cody. And a lot of times mamas that are in the ecosystem, which has a lot of bears in it, will move out into those places to raise a cub where there's less chance of it getting injured by a big bear.
And what do you do with them when you find them?
Sometimes we're trying to catch them to ride back to the mountains to get it away from people and make, you know, not only the bears safer, but the people safer as well, or they have the situation it's in. It could be livestock related or human interface related. But sometimes we just watch the bear and observe who they are, or, you know, if we can find out if it's a male or a female, if they have young with them, how old that we think they are. And there's some things you start to pick up on over time that you notice and just take all that into account and basically just gather as much information as you can about who the bear is and what they're doing out there.
And the very last question, what is the craziest thing that has ever happened to you as a wildlife biologist?
Well, there's a lot of good stories that are pretty fun. We were working on we were actually helping South Dakota Fish and Wildlife and Parks, or Fish and Game. Everybody's got a different nomenclature for, but it's basically the South Dakota Game and Fish. And we were helping them with a mountain lion survey. And so we would tree the mountain lions with dogs, and then we shoot a biopsy dart into it, like their butt or their shoulder. And it takes a little piece of flesh and comes down, and they can compare all that with a genetic analysis, all the little samples we take, and we just let the lion go. Well, one time the dogs were following a lion and they went into a cave, and we had to crawl into the cave. And Luke, the guy that owns the dogs, was up in the front of the cave and I was in the back, and he said, "Look out, he's coming out." And so I had one hound dog in my hands and I just rolled over on it, and that lion shot right past me at about, well, I could have reached out and touched it. So sometimes you get wild things that happen like that.
Cool. Well, that is pretty awesome. And I saw on a show one time that there are like white grizzlies and white black bears, and there are black, and like the rest of their family is black and or brown.
You can get different color cubs from the same litter. And sometimes those cubs will be different fathers. So bears have a thing called delayed implantation, where there can be a baby egg inside of them, but it doesn't actually start growing as a baby until they go to sleep in hibernation. And so when she has to be about 23 to 25% body fat minimum to actually have an egg attached to her uterine wall. So that baby can roll around inside her for a while, and if she's not in good condition, she doesn't have it. And so that's why sometimes you have a couple different colored babies that can come from one sow, one female, which usually that the different colors come more in black bears, but you can get different shades in the grizzlies as well.
Well, I don't have any more questions. After talking to my expert, I would describe the animals of Wyoming as unique and amazing. Wildlife biologists need to study the bears and wolves of Wyoming because they are important creatures to our ecosystem. They are predators and an important part of the food chain. They also need to study them because sometimes they can be dangerous, especially when they come into areas where people live and like to recreate. We also want to protect them so they can continue to be part of our ecosystem in the future.
Hi, my name is David Buckles. I'm 8 years old, and I live in Cody, Wyoming. One of the things that makes Wyoming special to me is Heart Mountain. I can see it from my backyard. When I was 6, I hiked to the top of Heart Mountain, and I thought it was really awesome. Heart Mountain is an important landmark for people that live in my community in Northwest Wyoming. It has been seen and used by people for thousands of years, especially Native Americans. To learn more about Heart Mountain, I decided to talk to Carrie and Brian Peters. They are the ranch managers of Heart Mountain Preserve.
What's your job at Heart Mountain?
So Heart Mountain is actually owned by an organization called the Nature Conservancy. And we both work for the Nature Conservancy on Heart Mountain Ranch. I'm a conservation practitioner, and Brian is the ranch manager, and we've been there for about 14 years now. So, and we do all things related to taking care of the ranch.
When I hiked to the top of Heart Mountain, I did not see any animals. Why not?
There are a lot of animals up there, very regularly, and depending on when you hiked, could have been the time of the day, could have been when things possibly migrated off the property, but That's a very good question. Sometimes just the animals are very sensitive to the sounds of other people up there, so they could have just moved away. And then it's just very, very variable why, unfortunately, you didn't see animals up there. That was kind of a bummer, I bet, for you.
And why, when I look at Heart Mountain, it looks like a person sleeping on his back? Why is that?
We agree with you 100% that it does look like that. And a lot of people also think that. So that's really perceptive that you picked up on that. And, you know, Heart Mountain has a very unique shape to it, both because of how it was formed and also because of erosion, you know, years and many, many, many years of erosion. Heart Mountain actually, the upper part of Heart Mountain actually came from an area over by Cook City, Montana, which is about 60 miles from here. There was an area that had volcanic activity over there, and there was a mountainous area that actually experienced a collapse because of that volcanic activity. And when that collapsed, it sent pieces of that mountain over here. And so there's actually a chunk of mountain that was over at Cook City that is now the top of Heart Mountain. And so that's part of why it has that very unique look to it. So the fact that a lot of people see a sleeping person is kind of just by chance, you know, I mean, it's because of that unique shape to it. And I just think it's really cool that people have used their imagination to see that sleeping person in the mountain. So
did the Native Americans think it looked like a heart?
That is true. We've heard that from multiple different people, and we know for sure the Crow tribe thought it will look like a buffalo heart. So it's a very good question, and we've heard that a lot.
Do you know how many different kinds of animals are on Heart Mountain?
That's a very tough question. So there are hundreds and hundreds of animals that live up on Heart Mountain, from various very small ones like those little mountain snails up there, clear to where we have, you know, big grizzly bears even up on the property. So yeah, there's a lot of different animals, birds. We have lots and lots of various birds that come through. So it's really exciting. There's a lot of different critters that call that mountain home during various parts of the year.
It's a lot. And we do have some lists, you know, that have been put together by various researchers or interested folks. But it's not all encompassing. It doesn't include everything that is there, but it's hundreds, and it's a lot.
Is there a bear den on Heart Mountain? Have you seen one?
Yes, there is a bear den on Heart Mountain, and we have seen it. And the last we knew about it, there was a black bear that was utilizing it for a den, but it could be a different bear now, you know, it could be a grizz possibly. So, but yes, we do have at least one bear den up there.
Have you seen wolves on Heart Mountain?
So we both have seen very faint glimpses. So we were discussing that even earlier this year, if we could actually say we saw one. We're like 99% sure, but we see their tracks a lot up there. And we do have a lot of wolves that from time to time have come through. And a lot of times they come from the mountain ranges there just to the west there, coming from the Absorcas, and they just kind of make loops around the mountain and travel back and forth with other species. And so they're definitely present up there for sure.
Do you know if there's long-billed curlews on Heart Mountain?
Yeah, we see curlews on Heart Mountain Ranch quite often. They really like that the lower part of the ranch, kind of that flat area with all the sagebrush, and we call it Buck Creek Flats, but they
really like to hang out in that area and nest out there and everything. And we've actually hosted curlew researchers on the ranch numerous times over the last 8 to 10 years. And they've actually captured some of the curlews that have been spending time on Heart Mountain and put radio transmitters on them. And so we can track, you know, their movement all year round. And the curlews that spend the spring and early summer on Heart Mountain, they actually travel all the way down clear to Mexico to spend the winter down there. And then they hang out down there, and then they turn around and come right back to Heart Mountain and this area. And so we get to see maps and stuff of where exactly they travel during the year. And that's a pretty long travel all the way down to Mexico and back in a year. So yeah, there are a lot of them on Heart Mountain.
Is it hard working at Heart Mountain?
You know, it's a really fun job, and we both really like it. But there are challenges. So there are things that come up in our jobs that make it, you know, hard at times to try to think through, you know, how we're going to proceed with something or how to handle a certain situation that has come up. But so there are times that it's hard, but overall it's a really fun place to work, and we feel very blessed to be able to do that. So if you have anything to add to that.
No, you said it very well. We both enjoy working up there, and we enjoy the challenges of it, and it's a very, very unique place, and so we both really love it.
It's so neat for us to get to talk to kids like you who are so smart and so interested in Heart Mountain and just want to learn more and more and more. And so that's really special. So thanks a lot for being interested in Heart Mountain.
Before I spoke with Karen Bryan, I thought Heart Mountain was a cool place. Now I think Heart Mountain is even more amazing. If it wasn't protected, the habitats would be destroyed, and we wouldn't be able to hike there and enjoy it. Heart Mountain should be protected because there's a lot of animals like bears and curlews and maybe even wolves that live there. If I was an animal, I think I would love to live on Heart Mountain.
And that's why we ask why.
Charlotte and David spoke to people that have different careers that help wildlife. So what career would you choose that would help wildlife stay wild? And how would it help? Share your answers with us on Facebook at the Kids Ask Why podcast page or Twitter at Center of the West. Thanks for listening to this episode of Kids Ask Why. If you want to learn more about Heart Mountain, grizzly bears, wolves, or any of the other wildlife that was mentioned today, you can check out our website, kidsaskwhy.org, where we have lots of different resources. Tune in next week.
This podcast is produced by Emily Buckles, Gretchen Henrich, Megan Smith, and Kirsten Arnold. Our executive producer is Camilla Kodolska. Levi Meyer and Anna Rader are our digital consultants. Kids Ask Why is a production of the Buffalo Bill Center of the West in Wyoming Public Media.
Don't forget, you can find all of our podcasts, whether it's this one, The Modern West, Human Nature, and much, much more, on our website. That's located at wyomingpublicmedia.org. In a moment, we will wrap up the program. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
The Wyoming Public Media app is home to Wyoming Public Radio and so much more. Find on-demand content from Morning Edition and All Things Considered, listen to our local newscast, and you can help our reporting with the Talk to Us option. Simply record your message, hit send, and we'll have your feedback instantly. Just search for Wyoming Public Media in your app store.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. When we talk about air quality, we are usually talking about the air outside, whether it's affected by wildfires, smog, or even factory emissions. But those conversations typically end at the front door. The COVID-19 pandemic has made many of us think about indoor air in a whole new way. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports.
At the daycare at the University of Wyoming, you see a lot of what you'd expect. Toys, books, cubbies for tiny shoes, and that's not all.
We've got air purifiers, we've got CO2 detectors.
That's Mark Bittner. He's in charge of this place. He says those machines were added to reduce the risk of catching COVID-19.
I just really needed to find a way to help mitigate. Okay, what can we do now that we know these things are airborne? We have kids that some of them are too young to wear masks, so what can we do to help protect the children, help protect the staff that are here a little bit better?
The daycare's HVAC system got a boost to recirculate air more frequently, and each classroom now has an air purifier. And then there's the CO2 device.
It's not measuring COVID in the air, it's just measuring CO2 levels.
Here's why that's useful. CO2 is what we breathe out. So if there's a lot of it in a room, the air isn't fresh. You're more likely to breathe in the same air someone else just breathed out. But if the CO2 detector shows numbers on the higher end, Bittner says it's still not as if an alarm goes off.
It's not a panic, it's just find ways to move the air a little bit better.
Like opening a window or turning on a fan. These kinds of mitigation efforts happened all over the country as people were thinking hard about indoor air, many for the very first time.
As a result, most of us in this field have been working nonstop.
That's Shelley Miller, a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Colorado Boulder.
To try to communicate, provide interviews, write articles, put stuff on Twitter, just like any way we can possibly get the word out.
Get the word out about indoor air quality. Miller says historically, people have paid way more attention to the air outside, but even that started not so long ago.
We only realized in the 1950s that air pollution could kill you because of the London outbreak.
She's talking about the Great Smog of 1952. It was 5 days of disastrous air pollution, thanks to unusually frigid and windless weather combined with pollution from burning coal.
The sky and the light were blotted out, and London coughed and crawled almost to a standstill in murky yellow gloom.
The Great Smog shut down the city and caused thousands of deaths, and it spurred the UK's Clean Air Act of 1956. People realized that if we want clean air, the government needs to regulate that. And just as importantly, Miller says it gave way to thinking about outdoor air as a public good, something that we all share. But she says we haven't come around to that kind of thinking for indoor air.
What's happened with indoor air is that it's become a private good. This is your home. This is your space. The government is not going to invade your space or your home or your office building.
But better air quality at home can keep you healthy in a number of ways, filtering allergens, dust, as well as pathogens that make you sick. It's possible the COVID-19 pandemic could trigger change the way the Great Smog did. It could be a paradigm shift for indoor air. In fact, 39 scientists are calling for just that in a report published in the journal Science earlier this month. Miller and her CU Boulder colleague and aerosol expert, Jose Luis Jimenez, are two of those researchers.
So our society has been very successful at removing pathogens from water or from food. And they are very, complex, sophisticated systems that work very, very well.
We've come to expect our drinking water to be clean and the food we buy at the grocery store to be safe. But Jimenez says we're not there yet with indoor air.
Something our society just hasn't done it.
Jimenez and others say it's time for that change. The group of researchers wants to see standards for indoor air quality that include airborne pathogens and that are enforced. But that doesn't have to be complicated or even expensive. It can be as simple as plugging in a $100 CO2 detector and, if need be, opening a window. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. To hear segments and past programs and to find all of our podcasts, go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. And while you're there, consider making a donation to support the station and specifically our award-winning Wyoming news content. We've gotten some good ideas for future features from many of you. If you have an idea for a story or an interview, you can contact me through our website or via social media. If you're on Twitter, you can follow the station or our individual reporters. I have the handle ButterBob. Thanks to Anna Rader for her outstanding work as our digital editor, and have a tremendous holiday weekend. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.